This is 1-2-1 on BCB 106.6 FM.
So I'm lucky enough now to be joined in the studio by Maggie Eisner. So Maggie was a GP in Shipley.
After I retired, I became a volunteer medico-legal report writer, and that's writing reports for people who are seeking asylum because they've been tortured in the country they've come from.
You've recently been diagnosed with a
glioblastoma.
So people listening might not even know what that is.
Indeed, they might not. So, and I didn't know much about it. I had had one patient with a glioblastoma in 30 years of general practice. Yeah, it is quite rare. And so I was perfectly well until about lunchtime on December the 21st. When I started thinking my speech was going a bit funny, and then I went a bit weak down one side and started having fits and was whizzed off to BRI in an ambulance. And within 3 hours, they had the diagnosis of a brain tumour.
So you went from feeling perfectly fine, not aware that there was anything wrong, and then...
Not aware at all.
Not at all?
Not at all.
Oh. And then 3 hours later, you had this diagnosis.
Yes.
To say that must have been a shock, Maggie, is a terrible understatement.
Yes. I mean, I think I was feeling peculiar enough for shock. I was conscious, but I certainly felt very peculiar by that at that point.
Yeah.
So I stayed in BRI over Christmas, and I'd just like to say that it was very nice on Ward 33 at BRI.
Was it?
It was.
Did they do Christmas well?
Very well. They were very, very nice to me.
Hmm.
And that, I would say, went from the cleaners and the people who served the food and the healthcare assistants and the porters and everybody, as well as the... higher ranking
yes.
healthcare professionals. And during that time, I had a lot of tests because at first they thought that it was a secondary cancer from another site. Like lung cancer or breast cancer can give you brain secondaries, but they didn't find any evidence of anything like that. And so by the time I left BRI, I knew that I had a primary brain tumour. But I didn't know how bad it was. Then I went to LGI and I had a biopsy of the tumour under general anaesthetic. And then they found that it was a highly malignant, aggressive glioblastoma and that my life expectancy, the average life expectancy, would be 6 months to 2 years. And there isn't... You don't often have less or more than that. So maybe 1% of people might live 5 years, but it's pretty unlikely.
So that's what you're living with at the moment?
Yes.
You're living with that information?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
So then they did various tests on the tissue from the tumour, which enabled them to decide what treatment I should have. I couldn't have surgery because of where the tumour is.
Where is it, Maggie?
It's on the left-hand side near the bottom of my brain, sort of about... I'm pointing,
yes.
pointing to the left-hand side of my head.
Yeah.
It's too near the part that controls speech, which is why they wouldn't want to operate, really. I've had the standard treatment, which is 3 weeks radiotherapy together with 3 weeks chemotherapy. The chemo wasn't too bad because it was by mouth, and that's at St James's. And then I'm going to have every month, 6 months, 5 days more chemotherapy. So I'm just at the end of that first 5 day bout.
And I guess at this point we should start to refer to the music because as we're going to be talking together, we're going to intersperse it with pieces of music that are important to you.
Yes.
Sort of speak of you know, important times in your life.
Yes.
So would you like to tell us about your first piece of music, Maggie?
Yes. So this is the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto, and it it's to do with my mother, but let's listen to it and then I'll tell you about her.
So that was Mendelssohn's Violin Concerto, Maggie. Beautiful piece of music.
Mm.
And you were saying it relates to your mum, to your mother.
Yes. So I wanted to talk about my mum first because I think that she's a big part of the reason why I'm able to cope with what's happening to me.
Right.
And I think it's partly because she had enormous resilience throughout her life. And
so we talk about resilience, don't we? It's quite a common word these days. What did that mean in your mum? What did that look like?
Okay, so she, I mean, I'll have to tell you about her life and what happened to her.
Okay.
So my parents were refugees from Central Europe and they came to, actually, South Wales, at the very beginning of 1939, and my mum had come from a small village in the north of Romania, sort of next to Ukraine, which had a very large Jewish population before the war. But she went all the way to Prague, which was pretty much as far from her home as Prague is from London. So
a long way.
Prague in Czechoslovakia, when she was 17, to study medicine. And she met my father and they got married. And my father was Czech from Prague. And they came to England, like I said. She was a doctor. And my father worked abroad when I was little. I was born in 1947. And oh, there's so much to say about her, really. She was an amazing woman. Yes, when she came to Britain, she thought she was going to have to retake all her medical qualifications all over again.
Oh.
Much like the sort of thing that happens to refugee doctors now, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
And in fact, by 1942, in the middle of the war, foreign doctors were allowed to work in some areas of medicine, so that's what she did. So resilience, well, she was practically a single parent all the time, really, because my father was away so much and then he died when I was 10. We'd moved to London by then. And she just kept going. She just kept on and on working. And I think money was a bit short because in her branch of medicine, they weren't paid very well at all. But I never had any sense that money was short. She just protected me from that, really. And then there was my father's death, and she got over that, and she lived most of her life as a single person. I was an only child. She worked until she was 70, and then after that she used to go on exciting cultural foreign holidays. So she moved up to Bradford when she was in her late 70s and lived down the road from me. And she gradually declined into dementia and went on living at home. We were able to have 24-hour care for her at home. And by she died at the age of 102 in 2015. Wow. And she had, her death was so easy, really. When I was GP, I used to do home births. And the night she died reminded me of a home birth. There was a group of quite giggly people in the room, and she was getting on with the dying.
Yeah.
And it was just a very... It was a very healing experience, because although I smile enormously when I talk about her now, actually we had quite a, we were very close, we had a very intense relationship, but I never quite felt that she thought I was good enough or approved of me or that kind of thing. Like, well, that happens a lot with, I think, mothers and children. But somehow when she developed dementia, her... criticalness fell away and her kindness came out.
So during that process you were able to build a whole new chapter of relationship.
Definitely,
with your mum.
Definitely. And I think all of that experience is a kind of one of the bricks that gives me the strength to face the situation I'm in, if that makes sense.
It makes absolute sense.
Yes.
It really does. So your experience of your mum's death was that it was a good death.
Oh, very.
A good death.
Very, very.
And it was a healing thing, and it had that almost that sense that you might have at a home birth.
Yes.
But it's okay.
Yes. I might add, however, that I have had, until December the 21st, a great fear of declining into dementia myself.
Have you?
And one of the advantages of knowing that that is exceedingly, exceedingly unlikely to happen to me is that I'm quite comforted. And I think to myself, at least I'm not going to have to decline into dementia. And I think at least I'm not going to have to live through Brexit.
Mackie...
True.
And on that note, shall we play the next piece of music that you brought along?
And so this is The Joy of Living by Ewan McColl, and it's going to introduce you to my husband Steve.
Farewell, you northern hills, you mountains, all goodbye. Moorland and stony ridges, crags and peaks, goodbye. Gledafach, farewell. Cobaig, Scawfell, cloud-bearing Suvan. Sun-warmed rock and the cold of Bleaklow's frozen sea. The snow and the wind and the rain of hills and mountains. Days in the sun and the tempered wind and the air like wine. And you drink and you drink till you're drunk on the joy of living.
So that was The Joy of Living.
Yes.
Joy of Living. And you say this is a good song to introduce us to your husband, Steve.
Yes. So I met Steve in 1984, very shortly after I moved to Bradford. And he was a Bradford lad, born and bred. Steve's grandchildren, and they're still quite a big part of my life. His daughter Nina and her three children live not so very far away from me. And Floss is 17 and Bella is 15 and Eli is 10. And they're great. They're great friends of mine. And it's lovely to have young people in my life. two things that we shared were a love of the outdoors and a love of political folk music. And
right.
Ewan McColl is, he certainly was a political singer, although this isn't a political song. This one he wrote when he noticed that he was getting weaker and couldn't climb the mountains as high as his family could.
Right.
And so he would sit at the bottom of the mountain or bottom of the steepest part, and they would climb up and then they'd come back down to him. And makes me feel emotional thinking about it. Steve and I heard Ewan McColl sing this in the Topic Folk Club very shortly before he died. And Steve was a very single-minded person and a very, very committed socialist. He was active in trade union activity when he was younger. He'd worked in engineering, and then when there wasn't engineering to do in Bradford, he retrained as a teacher. And he loved being a teacher. He loved children. Mm. He had some reservations about schools, but he loved children.
Yes. I think that makes a lot of sense. I'm sure there's a lot of teachers who feel that way.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So.
And I can see when you're talking about him, you've got a real, I don't know, almost like a wistful expression on your face as you're talking about him. Yeah.
Yes. Well, I was saying he was keen on the outdoors.
Yeah.
And he took up paragliding.
Oh, my word.
In middle age. I think he was 50 when he started. He had a paragliding accident in 2002. Fell out of the sky. A gust of wind really brought him back to land when he'd only just taken off. And he had a serious spinal injury, which meant that he couldn't walk properly and he had to give up work.
Oh, gosh.
So that was in 2002. He got a lot of joy out of his grandchildren, and he was quite slim and very, very, very determined. And so he got himself about without ever taking to a wheelchair.
How did he do that?
He had some movement in his legs, and he could ride a bicycle on the flat. I mean, he'd ridden a bicycle all his life. So there's another example of resilience that I had.
Absolutely,
to,
live with,
you know.
Yes.
And so he did pretty well. But in 2011, I was on a walking holiday with a friend because he wouldn't have been able to go on a walking holiday. We were in Northern Ireland, and I came back, I'd found him dead.
Oh,
he'd died of meningitis, which meant that he hadn't suffered much at all.
No.
And he definitely would have preferred to be on his own. He wouldn't have wanted a lot of fuss at all.
Yeah.
So it was probably a death that suited him. Mm. So, again, I mean, it did take me a while to get over it, you can imagine. But I felt it was right for him to die at that time.
Yeah.
So I suppose that's a second example of it being right to die, and a feeling that life has a beginning and it has an end. So that thought may have found its way into my head.
Yes,
that.
And that's very different from what happened with your mum, isn't it? Where you had that preparation because of the...
Oh, utterly different.
Yeah, because you knew that it was coming.
Yeah. And we had a lovely memorial event for him, and we planted 250 trees in an hour.
In an hour?
Yeah, there were 50 of us, I think, at least.
Even so, that's quite an achievement.
Yeah, there were little trees, and it was for... forgotten the name of the organisation. One of the very annoying features of this brain tumour, or possibly a side effect of the radiotherapy, is that I'm slightly worse at forgetting names and words than I otherwise would have been.
And does that bother you?
Yes, it does. I like to be perfect, really.
And organised with things. I can imagine that that's a great frustration.
Yes, I'm having to get used to that.
Yeah, and it could be the...
Be anything,
it could be
knows.
Anything.
Or it could be being feeling tired.
Or it could be feeling tired.
Yeah.
And we've got a piece of music now that puts you in mind of your adopted daughter.
So this is Caro Mio Ben, and it's by Giordani, I think. And my daughter used to sing like an angel. This isn't her, this is Leslie Garrett.
So your daughter used to be able to sing like that?
Yes.
Amazing.
Yes, she did. It just made your spine tingle and your heart melt.
Yes, yes.
And it was, she could sing like an angel. I lost her in 2008. We adopted her when she was three in 1988. And she was a dear little girl. But she had a lot of troubles and she self-harmed a lot through her teens. And she got into some really bad relationships, which didn't help at all. And she always wanted to make a fresh start, and it never worked out for her. I think, sometimes, like anybody, I think, could I have done better and could I have been a better parent? And of course I could have been a better parent, but I don't suppose that would have saved her. Steve and I were very different, and I think he was a much better parent when she was little, but I think I was a better parent when she was a teenager. And, having two parents is quite useful. Anyway, she tried various things. She tried going to music college because, of course, she did sing so wonderfully. But in the end, it all got too much for her, and she took her life in 2008. So, I mean, that was actually less of a shock than Steve's death, because Colleen had done a lot of self-destructive things before, and I sort of did have a sense that it might come to a bad end. But at the time that she died, she had a lovely, lovely partner, and they were living in a dear little house which I'd bought them with my retirement lump sum. Sometimes I think that she thought to herself, everything's as good as it could be, but I'm still going to mess up, so I might as well go now. That's the sort of thing I imagine might have been in her head.
Gosh.
I think she was afraid that she would go on hurting people she loved, because she knew that that was what she did. I forgot to mention, I probably should have done, that an element in her troubles was probably that her mother drank alcohol when she was pregnant, added to a very chaotic infancy. Mm. So the two things, really. Not being securely loved in infancy, and her brain not being quite right because of the alcohol. But anyway, what I was going to go on to say was that her partner at that time, a woman called Sal, is one of my very, very bestest people now. We're really, really close. And every year, round about Cole's birthday in July, we do a physical challenge to raise money for Young Minds.
Right.
And so far we've raised over £30,000. We've done it for 10 years. Well, she did it the first year. She did a skydive. We did canyoning last year.
And is that you, that sense of I've got all this in front of me, and it's the sort of stuff that could have some people running screaming for the hills, really, but actually your approach is very much to deal with it and to work out what you can do, something constructive to make the best of it.
Yes, that's me.
That's you.
That's me.
Yeah.
Although, as I've probably suggested, that song has grown over my life.
Yeah.
I don't think if you'd asked me 30 years ago whether I was like that,
yeah,
whether I would have been quite like that. Some of that's the life experiences that I've had.
Yeah, that have shaped you and brought you to where you are right now.
Yes.
We've got more music, Maggie. Are you ready another one?
Yes. So this one is Ella's song by Sweet Honey in the Rock. And it'll brings me into thinking about my working life.
Not needing the light just to shine on me. I need to be one in the number as we stand against tyranny. Myself don't mean a whole lot. I've come to realize that teaching others to stand and fight is the only way I struggle survive. Oh, oh, are we who believe in freedom?
The song's very wide-ranging. So, I do notice at times I can be quite difficult. I bow to no man's word and think, well, yes, probably that's reasonably true. But in fact, the verses that really touch me are, first of all, that which touches me most is that I had a chance to work with people, passing on to others that which was passed on to me. And that makes me think about my career as a GP. And since my diagnosis, and particularly since there was an article about me in the TNA, I've had a couple of messages from patients about how something I did or said made a real difference to their lives. And I hadn't known. And it's wonderful to think that that's the case. And then passing on to others that which was passed on to me makes me think about my career well, my the other half of my career as a training program director of the Bradford GP training scheme. And it's partly teaching and it's partly rather tedious organisational stuff. But I've loved the relationships I've had with GP trainees. And I've had very, very, very many warm and appreciative comments from them, which has been lovely. And one of the things I'd like to say about warm and appreciative comments is that it's lovely to get them now, but actually there could be a case if you feel warm and appreciative towards someone, say it when you feel it and yes. don't wait until they're in desperate straits, because I think it would make the world a better place, really.
Why do you think people wait?
Well, it strikes me that one reason might be that they didn't realise at the time.
That makes me think about the reason we're doing this programme together, which is to do with Dying Matters Week. And that's, we don't talk about feelings, whether they're positive, good feelings, or whether they're scary, difficult feelings.
That's probably true. The other verse in this song that I really like is, "To me, young people come first. They have the courage where we fail. And if I can but shed some light as they carry us through the gale." And, I mean, at the moment, it makes me think of the leadership that young people are showing in the environmental movement. But generally, my generation of GPs tend to think that we had the best of it and that we could do continuity of care, for example. We weren't as stuck for resources as GPs are now. We weren't as short-staffed as they are now. But when I've talked to some of my ex-trainees who've come and seen me, people in perhaps their 40s, I found that they actually also bring a tremendously positive spirit to the job. And so it makes me realise that you should trust young people, really.
Another piece of music.
Yes, so this one, it's by another very favourite singer that Steve and I used to like to go and listen to. We first heard him at Glastonbury in 1984, as it happens. It's called "Missing You," and it's about exile.
Missing you, I'd give all for the price of the flight. Oh, I'm missing you under Piccadilly neon. I took you for in 1986. There's not much for a chippy or swinging a pick, and you can't live on love and on love alone. So you sail across the ocean, away across the foam, to where you're a Paddy, you're a Biddy, you're a Mick, good for nothing but stacking a brick. And your best mate's a spade and he carries a heart, two workhorses heavily shod. Oh, I'm missing you, I give all for the price of the flight. Oh, I'm missing you under Piccadilly's neon. Who did you murder, or are you a spy? I'm fond of a drink, helps me laugh, helps me cry. Never just drink red biddy for a permanent high, and I'll laugh a lot less and I'll cry till I die. Of the flight. Oh, I'm missing you under Piccadilly's neon.
So that was "Missing You,"
yeah,
by Christy Moore.
Yeah. The reason I chose this song is because it's about the experiences that refugees have, just reminding me really what it all feels like. And I very much liked the work that I did writing medico-legal reports for refugees who'd been tortured. That was in Manchester. And, of course, I'm a child of refugees. And I'm involved with Bradford Friendship Choir. It's always at the top of my consciousness, really, thinking about refugees and thinking about what it's like and thinking about, well, sort of thinking there, but for the grace of God go I, maybe, some sort of feeling, feeling so sad that the word refugee and the word asylum seeker have got such bad connotations, and they're all just people. Yeah, it's always something I think about, and I like to try and help where I can.
So shall we have another piece of music?
This one is by the Peace Artists, whom I'm sure are well known to BCB. They're a wonderful street band who've been going since I came to Bradford. So they must have been going for nearly 40 years, I think. It's called Bradford, We Love You. And I'm playing this because ever since I've come to live in Bradford in 1982, I've come to love it more and more. And I've got loads of friends in Bradford.
Pleased we met day, Bradford. We love you, Bradford. Starlings above you, your mills may all be shut down, but you're still my kind of town.
Rome is full of Vespers, and Paris has its clowns. Chicago's got its gangsters. Now let me think of other towns. In Tokyo there's sushi bars. In London there is fog and cars. But Bradford, we love you, Bradford.
I'd like to spend an evening with the film stars in Bombay. A coffee shop in Amsterdam could really make my day. But I get a tingling that is strange when we pull into the interchange in Bradford.
So the Peace Artists.
Yes. So apart from being a great deal of fun, the words of Bradford, We Love You, always remind me of what a unique place it is. It's the right size of town, I think. And I live at the Shipley end, and it's just a lovely place around here. And I've made such good friends. And in terms of cancer, I think Now might be the time to start talking about the people I've got to support me, because, as I said at the beginning of the interview, I don't have much immediate family. I've got some cousins whom I'm very fond of, but they're not nearby. And it just feels to me that if you put energy in your life into making good friends, then they're available when you need them. That's been something that's happened to me since I've lived in Bradford, and I feel really settled here and really happy here. One of the worst things about having a brain tumour is you're not allowed to drive.
Right.
I'm not allowed to drive.
So that's a massive loss of independence.
Oh, massive, massive. Yeah. I think that might be the worst thing about my situation.
Really?
Yes. Yes. I'm fortunate because I live quite near the main road, so I can get the bus along the main road. But I'm unfortunate because I live on the side of a valley.
Yes,
so,
yes.
And I live up a hill. So if ever I go anywhere, I go out downhill. But when I'm coming back, I'm tired and it's going uphill. Mm. And I just have to get used to it. However, talking about going uphill, here is my next hints and tips.
Yes.
Which is that very, very many cancers and treatments for cancer can make you very short of energy. And I'm at the moment suffering from something which is called late fatigue after radiotherapy. And what they say in the book, apart from saying keep hydrated, which is I found very useful, is that rest doesn't help the fatigue very much. Absolutely found that when I've been suffering from fatigue, it's been better for me to do some exercise. Yeah. I come back feeling more energetic. And there's a little walk I do in Heaton Woods, which is about 45 minutes. And at the moment, the bluebells just
gorgeous.
Gladden your heart.
And they smell so nice,
and
don't they?
And what I find is that if I'm going, a friend's going with me, I usually find that walking up the hill where I live, because I live halfway up it, I'm feeling really breathless and thinking, goodness me, normally I could walk at least as fast as this person, and beating myself up a bit. But by the time we're halfway round, I'm keeping pace with them and I've got my energy back. And I have another top tip. Mentioning the bluebells reminded me. If you have a happy moment, notice it and treasure it. So yesterday, when I went out with my friend, we were chatting away about this and that, and suddenly I noticed the spring foliage, which is such bright green on the trees. I mean, it's just an unbelievably bright, 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 bright green. And I think another year I wouldn't have noticed it. And I said to her, stop and just look at that foliage. So my number two top tip, or one of my top tips, is treasure happy moment. Notice and treasure happy moment.
And you don't think you would have done that last year?
No. I'd have been pounding on.
So it's making you
more aware. Definitely.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely. Mm. I mean, this sense that it might be the last time that you're going to do something is
very
intense.
Well, I was going
intense.
To say that, and I wasn't sure whether I actually was going to be brave enough to say, do you think that's because this might be the last time that you see that flush of spring colour like that?
Oh, yes. I'm very aware that I may not be there next spring.
Yeah.
And at first I was wondering whether to plant any seeds in my garden for things that would, fruit and veg that would come up in autumn. I can probably risk that. I'll do that. Oh, let's move on. This is My Sisters Are With Me, and I'll tell you a bit more about it when you've played it.
My sisters are with me.
Sisters are with me.
Ooh, yeah, when I need them most. Yeah, my sisters are with me.
Sisters are with me.
Ooh, yeah, when I need them most. When I've gone to my extreme, all of my work in vain it seems, and my sisters stand. My sisters are with me.
Sisters are with me.
Ooh, yeah, when I need them most. Yeah, my sisters are with me.
Sisters are with me.
Ooh, yeah, when I need them most. When I've gone to my extreme, all of my work in vain, it seems that my sisters
than I can bear. When I'm about to fall beneath the weight of care, my sisters will help me.
Sisters will help
me. Ooh, yeah. When I need them most. When the meat is low and the money is gone. And when I feel most hopeless and lowest, then my sisters step right. My sisters are with me.
Sisters are with me.
Ooh, yeah. When I need them most, yeah, my sisters are with me.
Sisters are with me.
Ooh, yeah. When I need them most, when I've gone
to my extreme,
all of my work in vain, it seems, and my sisters
stand
right in the air. When I need them most, when my folks are fixing to drive me mad, feels like the worst times I've ever had, my sisters will help me.
Sisters will help me.
Ooh, yeah. When I need them most, when my lovers leave and I wish they'd stay, nothing but misery headed my way, then my sisters step right. My sisters are with me.
Sisters are with me.
Yeah, when I need them most. Yeah, my sisters are with me.
Sisters are with me.
Ooh, yeah, when I need them most.
So my sisters are with me, and that's the Bradford Women Singers.
That's the Bradford Women Singers, yes. Whom I sang with for, how long did I sing with? For nearly 30 years. My voice is in the chorus on that CD.
Can you hear yourself?
Probably not, no. Mm. And Mary Dowson, who's director of BCB, is also on that CD. And the solo is sung by my dear friend Suzanne, who's giving me a lot of help at the moment and driving me around a lot. So that's
a friendship circle right there, isn't it?
Oh, it absolutely is. Yes. So my sisters are with me. It just symbolises the amount of support that I feel and help, practical help and emotional support that I feel I'm getting from everybody.
How's it for you sort of receiving that help and support? Because, and I know we don't know each other very well, yeah. But I've got this impression of this... very independent, incredibly capable woman.
Yes.
Doing things that most people would consider to be very difficult and just cracking on with it, and then suddenly to be having to receive help and support.
Yes, that is difficult. Mm. It was particularly difficult when I first came home after I got my diagnosis and I had people staying with me every night. Oh. And I had people... doing things in my kitchen and putting things away in the wrong place.
Doing things in your kitchen?
Yes, and ooh. Filling the kettle too full.
Right.
And I realised that that was definitely a trigger point for me, and I must stay in charge of my own kitchen for as long as I possibly can, whereas people coming and doing my ironing, that's absolutely fine.
So it's keeping control of the bits that... matter to you,
yes.
The bits that really feel important.
I mean, clearly, I am going to have to adjust to accepting help more. But on the other hand, you do need to keep on doing what you can for as long as you can. I think some of the advice leaflets from the from Macmillan say, keep on doing the things you like doing and get other people to do things you don't like doing.
That sounds like good advice.
That's why I say, I'll carry on with the cooking and gardening and you can do the ironing. Thank you very much.
And the driving.
Yes. Interestingly enough, I never liked driving very much. It was very convenient, but I wasn't someone who loved being behind the wheel. Mm. So I suppose if I had, that would have been
even
worse.
Harder. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Did you want to ask me some more about the medico-legal report, right? I'm sorry that I'm not doing it.
Yeah.
I'm really sorry. But its report takes about 2 months by the time you've done three interviews and written it up and had it reviewed. And... I can't ever say that I'll be able to do something that takes 2 months, because my state might change during those 2 months.
Yeah.
So I had to give it up. But, yes, I loved doing it. I loved talking to the people and I loved the writing. I like writing very much. And although people sometimes said to me, isn't it terribly harrowing what you have to hear about, that's overcome by the fact that you know that you're doing something useful. When you're a GP and you're listening to a harrowing story, in your head, there's the thought, oh, what can I do for this person? Whereas you know what you can do for the medical legal report. You can write the best medical legal report you possibly can.
We've got 2 more pieces of music to share today.
Yes.
And the next one is True Colours.
Yes.
Shall we have it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Don't be discouraged, though I realize it's hard to take courage in a world full of people. You can lose sight of it all, and the darkness there inside you makes you feel so small. But I see your true color shining through. See your
I've heard various versions of this, and I know they sing it in Bradford Friendship Choir, actually, the choir for refugees and asylum seekers and their friends. But the version I've heard of it that has moved me most is the one by the Gay Men's Chorus of Los Angeles, which I've seen on YouTube. And it's just lovely seeing all these different men, different colours and ages, and but they're all gay and they're all able to sing about the person who they are. How lucky I've been to be able to be my true, authentic self at home and at work. Very little difference in the way I come across.
Do you think that is luck?
Well, yes and no. I think I was born that sort of person and I have been able to develop it. That authenticity and being your true self, and perhaps the way I'm facing this illness now is an example of that. And so when people say, how can you be so brave, is a word they sometimes use.
Brave.
That's a word they sometimes use. And
how do you feel about that word, brave?
It doesn't apply. It seems irrelevant to me. I don't think I'm being brave. I think I'm being me. And in fact, sometimes for the challenges that Sal and I have, they say, oh, aren't you brave? For example, we did some caving.
Now, that is brave.
Well, it would be brave if I was frightened of being in a cave.
OK. But when it comes to cancer, the whole concept of having to be brave and stay positive and fight, and this is common language.
Yes. Well, I particularly don't like the military language, the fight and the battle and all that. I first went on a Ban the Bomb march when I was 13, and I've still got a badge saying Youth Against the Bomb 1961. And I've always been very strongly in favour of peace, so I don't see why I should start using military language now. And the thing about being brave and fighting and all that, the other thing is that if you're actually not wanting to do that day, then it will make you feel like a failure, and it's a sort of victim blaming sort of thing to do. So I don't go for any of that, really. I'm I haven't chosen the song, but I am doing it my way. It depends so much on the situation you're in, doesn't it?
Yeah.
If you were a young woman with breast cancer and a young family, you're facing something very different from what I'm facing.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true. I think we've got one more piece of music, Maggie, haven't we?
We have.
One more.
So this is Lacrimosa from the Mozart Requiem. And that's not about staying positive.
Maybe.
That's about facing up to sadness.
it's the music that's designed to make you cry. And I was just wondering, quite cheekily, Maggie, if that's something you're going to have at your funeral. Have you got that far with planning?
Yes, I have been thinking about my funeral, and I've been thinking that probably I'll have, like, two events. I mean, I say I'll have. I hope the people would like to have on my... in my memory, a memorial event sometime after my funeral. And I am hoping that Bradford Festival Choral Society, of which I have been chair of trustees, might sing this at my funeral.
You want them to...
might sing this at the memorial event.
Wow.
I have sung in the Mozart Requiem, and I've sung this, and it's lovely to sing. And in fact, we did sing it at the funeral of another member of the choir not so long ago. So I have. I've been thinking quite a lot about my funeral. And
have you? And what you want?
Yes, yes.
What's it like doing that thinking now when you know that time is necessarily short?
Well,
are you thinking about what you want or what you want for other people?
Yes. No, it's much more what I want for other people.
Right.
And making sure that the people I'm really close to would be able to come to the actual burial. All my family are in the Woodland Burial Ground in Thornton, so I'm going to go there as well. And so, yes, thinking a lot about that and making it bearable for the people who are going to find it particularly difficult. And then having something that's more of a public celebration later on, because it might sound slightly immodest, but I know that there's quite a lot of people in Bradford who would like to memorialise my death. And so,
it doesn't sound immodest at all, Maggie. You've touched a lot of people in all the different things that you've done, and it's actually brilliant to be confident about that, I think.
Yes, yes. What a privilege to be able to feel that. How, you know, not so many people are able to say that. And I feel very kind of grateful that that's how it is, and that I can look back on my life at this stage and think, well, yeah, I did help a bit. I did. I am leaving the world a better place than just a little tiny bit.
And does knowing that make your current situation easier to deal with somehow?
Massively.
Massively.
Because I'm not... I have very few regrets. Mm. Obviously, there are things that I feel that I could have done better. But by and large, the general direction of things, I think I've done as well as I can for the people that I've come into contact with, mostly.
Mm. Well, I have to say, I feel it's been a privilege to have you come in and share your story so openly, Maggie. And I really do hope that people listening will use our conversation as a kind of trigger to start having those conversations within their own families and with the people that love them and mean something to them.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you. And if we've been able to help people, that's lovely.
Mm. We'll